Carmageddon. Perhaps we should coin a new phrase, climate-geddon, at the way things are going. We're getting kind of close. But we're going to talk about what we can do about that. We're going to take a look back in our first segment at one of my heroes, and of course a hero for many in the environmental movement. This is the 50th anniversary of Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. And the second half, we're going to be talking about not Silent Spring, but climate silence. We'll be checking with Desi Doyen, talking about the debates coming up tonight and what we can expect and hope for and wish for. And we'll also be checking in with our friend Daniel Kessler at 350.org. Last Friday, they delivered thousands of signatures demanding that one candidate, that would be Mitt Romney, declare what he thinks about climate change and what he's going to do about it should he win the White House. We'll find out how that went at that delivery date on Friday. We'll check in with Daniel at about 45 after the hour. But first, I want to welcome my first guest. Very pleased to have her. She has a new book out. It's very ambitious, very impressive. It's called Beyond Nature's Housekeepers, American Women in Environmental History. And the author of that book is Nancy Unger. And she's in my neck of the woods. She is an associate professor of history at Santa Clara University. And that new book just out. Congratulations on it. And welcome to the Green Front, Nancy.
Oh, thank you so much. It's really a great pleasure to be on your show.
Well, your name and book came to our attention when you wrote a fabulous column recently for the Baltimore Sun. It was titled Silent Spring, Echo Still Eloquent. And as I read through it, I was just astonished at how much it does resonate in terms of what's going on today and some of the criticisms she got and some of the same things that we're hearing today. I'll let you give some of those great quotes. But first of all, what prompted you to write a book about the women who have really led the environmental movement in this country going back a ways?
Well, I was interested in, I've taught women's history, I've taught environmental history, and they're always taught as these two completely separate topics, as if there's no overlap. And one of the things that really interests me is that I'm interested not only in the great women and great men in environmental history, but how being a man or being a woman really has affected how people look at the environment, how they respond to it. You know, that idea that gender really plays or has played an important role, I think it's been overlooked. And so it was something that really interested me that I really wanted to pursue.
And Rachel Carson, of course, is known by many, certainly even outside the environmental movement as well as she should be. What are some of the other names, though, that we may not have heard about that really contributed a great deal?
Well, I have to say, I'm not so much of a great environmental, you know, great women in environmental history type scholar. I'm more interested in what women in general, how they were responding, why were they responding differently to men. Having said that, my book is filled with all kinds of women whose names, you know, no one knows, from organizations like Women for a Peaceful Christmas, who fought against the waste that is associated with holiday celebrations. I look at the League Against Nuclear Dangers, a bunch of housewives in Wisconsin who are really trying hard to stop nuclear power plants from spreading in their communities. So there are, you know, I mean, I look at Lois Gibbs and of Love Canal, and I look at some other of the better knowns, but I look at a lot of lesser knowns as well.
Mm. And I really appreciate this because, first of all, the environment tends to get marginalized and women in history tend to get marginalized. So I'm sure that you've really filled a big gap here in doing this book. Some of the quotes, I just have to go to them because they're eerily, you know, familiar to us now. At the time Silent Spring came out, it was denounced, you say, in the popular press. Time magazine dismissed it as hysterically over-emphatic. And
well, I mean, women were simply, you know, pretty much dismissed as hysterically over-emphatic whenever they had a strong opinion. And in this case, the idea that a woman was actually going to try to talk about science was really quite appalling to many in the scientific community.
The implication that we're too emotional, perhaps, you know, even certain times of month, that's almost what it's saying.
Oh, no, absolutely, yes. I mean, you can't, you know, women are, you know, ruled by these cycles of the moon, and they're irrational, and so I'm with you. Rachel Carson is one of my heroes, not only because she was very well-informed and very smart, she just wouldn't rise to the bait. You know, she just wouldn't respond to this. She just continues to put forth her very compelling evidence.
And speaking of bait, in that same Time magazine article back then, a California reader complained to the magazine's editor that, quote, Miss Rachel Carson's reference to the selfishness of insecticide manufacturers probably reflects her communist sympathies. Well, one would laugh at that and say how ridiculous it sounds, and yet if you turn on Fox News, I've been on there debating Hannity on climate reality. I've been called a communist because I know Van Jones, who there sure is a communist. So this is not something that was just in the past. It's unbelievably still present.
Well, yeah, the you know, if you have those beliefs, you're a communist. If you're a woman, you're hysterical. No, these have been around for a long time, and with certain people, apparently they still resonate because they're still pulling these out.
Pulling them out of where? Exactly, that's the question. And why? Well, we all know there's special interests, but the fact that it's continuing to go on in 2012 with all kinds of evidence of, climactic catastrophe looming, it's really beyond belief, isn't it? I mean, just for a moment, step outside your professor and author role, and perhaps just as a woman, as a concerned American, perhaps as a mother, can you believe what's going on in terms of, attacking science?
Well, no, I can't, and it really is absolutely appalling to me that the idea that and the way that the language has been taken over. You know, no, we're no longer talking about global warming; we're talking about climate change. You know, those are two very different things. It bothers me very much that the language has been neutralized. That I think a lot of conservatives, in my opinion, are better at their use of language, and they know what words are, you know, the communist charge, the buzzwords that are really going to get people up in arms. I mean, so yeah, it disturbs me a great deal that it's happening, and it disturbs me that a lot of the conservatives that I hear and read are so skillful at making it happen.
And apparently impactful, because if you look at the results of polling, I mean, a majority of Republicans still doubt that climate change is real.
Yes.
Not so with Democrats and independents, but clearly there's a political partisanship when it should be really a practical concern. I'm sure you'd agree.
Well, I would, but I absolutely agree. But what concerns me is I think if you put those Republicans on a polygraph test, they believe what they're saying. You know, I don't think it's just political. I mean, I think a lot of people know that this isn't the case. But the people who are really, you know, the hardcore voters and supporters and so forth, they really believe that this is just claptrap. And that's what disturbs me so profoundly.
Hmm. You talked about calling it global warming versus climate change. There's a new term that some polling has suggested is even more effective, and that's climate disruption, because global warming can sound kind of positive to people who live in colder climes. Perhaps climate change just implies a little change, but climate disruption, or even, I would say, climate chaos, if that's not overstating it, perhaps could be more helpful.
I think you're exactly right about that. I think climate disruption is good. It's the sense that something has happened, something has been disrupted. It's not just sort of this natural, you know, chain of events. No, I like that term very much.
Good. Now, Rachel Carson sadly died at the young age of 56 back in 1964 of breast cancer. Was there any reason to believe that she had been exposed to pesticides and chemicals that might have contributed to her cancer?
As far as I know, there wasn't anything specifically, but we all know, all of us were exposed to all kinds of things. And in the day when she was talking about, you know, as she writes so lyrically, that, you know, DDT, that was celebrated. That was the cure-all. In my book, I talk about these women of the various plant and garden societies, and they're all excited, you know, how to apply DDT to your house plants. The idea that these were that chemicals that we now know that are, you know, are very toxic were celebrated as wonderful advances. So I think that Rachel Carson didn't have to be waiting around in toxic mire to be, as most Americans were, exposed to all kinds of chemicals in day-to-day products, you know, pesticides, detergents, those kinds of things.
My husband, who grew up on Long Island, remembers playing in the clouds from the pesticides that were being sprayed along with his friends. And by the way, several of his friends have died. This would be in their 60s of different kinds of cancer. So pretty scary stuff when you
consider
how...
Well, it is scary. And that op-ed that you mentioned actually appeared in a number of newspapers. And I've heard from people all around the country, and including several who wrote to me the stories like you just told. There's one woman who said, you know, her father died when she was 5 years old. He had been a sprayer of DDT. That was his job. And it was interesting, getting back to our earlier conversation, I got all kinds of very positive response to that op-ed, and I also got some very vicious hate mail.
No, I'm not surprised, you know, because the same thing happened to me, and you hear it all the time. We've had Dr. Michael Mann on, Catherine Hayhoe, these, you know, climate scientists who are the targets of hate mail, sometimes even death threats. I mean, it just is beyond belief, isn't it, that we're dealing with this?
Well, it is very frustrating. And now the nice thing that happened to me is I got hate mail I just dismissed, but I got some people who really disagreed with me in a respectful way, and we got to have some real exchange, and that was very useful. Well, where's your evidence for this? So I sent all kinds of evidence, and you know, with at least a couple of people, I really felt like, well, you know, maybe we can make some progress here. So it wasn't all, you know, even the negative email wasn't all, you know, a total loss. But the really vicious, you know, name calling, and you know that I'm, you know, I wasn't quite called a communist, but that I'm bad for the country, you know, by exposing these issues. That is disturbing.
You and Rachel Carson, and I suppose you could throw me in here too, because I'm always every week talking about these issues, as many people are, and yet it really seems to be so divided along political lines still. So we're going to be talking in the second half about the debate. But what are you hoping to hear that we've not heard before in this conspiracy of silence on climate change?
Well, actually, before I get on to that issue, I just wanted to back up a little bit. And Rachel Carson says, one of the things that she says is very important, is that people quit assuming, in her words, that somebody was looking after things, that the spraying must be all right or it wouldn't be done. You know, I mean, that I think is really profound. And one of the things that I love about the debates is that, first of all, it's for a lot of people who I don't think pay much attention to politics, they actually do pay attention. You know, they're listening and hearing. And I think, I hope what they're going to be listening for is, yeah, I'm not just going to assume that, you know, either party has all of the answers. What are they actually saying about this? Now, whether they're going to hear that or not, I don't know. But for me, what's exciting is that, particularly with the first debate, that always gets the most attention, the most viewers. So, I feel like, as many people have said, you know, the solution for democracy is more democracy. The more people we can have paying attention and listening, and particularly in this debate, when they're talking about domestic issues, with you, of course, I certainly hope that the environment is going to come up. This talk about jobs. I mean, I'm all for jobs, and I have the luxury of having one, and so I don't want to be cavalier about this. But you know, sacrificing the environment and the future of the nation for temporary jobs, a short time as a fix, is just not the solution. So I'm hoping that can come out.
There's no good jobs on a bad planet, right?
Precisely.
And speaking of long-term view, that's what Rachel Carson's message was, that, you know, it may not be worth a short-term, you know, use of pesticides in terms of long-term detrimental effects to our environment. And she emphasized the interconnectedness of life.
Well, and, yeah, you know, I mean, she does it. She not only says it, but she says it in a way that people can understand. I mean, her exact terms that I love, she says, quote, "Future historians may well be amazed by our distorted sense of proportion. How could intelligent beings seek to control a few unwanted species by a method that contaminated the entire environment and brought the threat of disease and death even to their own kind?" I mean, those are very strong words, but, you know, she was absolutely right.
Well, it is in our self-interest to survive and to thrive. That's what's so astonishing and appalling about this, you know, blind spot that is being cultivated.
Well, exactly. And I think that not only was she right about that, but as I mentioned before, she also refuses to be thrown off the track. You know, when there are these accusations that she's a communist, that she's an idiot, the California reader who wrote to The New Yorker added to his email, "As for insects, isn't it just like a woman to be scared to death of a few little bugs?" You know, there's an attempt to discredit her because she's female, and to discredit her science. And she just remains, you know, very calm and continues to make her arguments, and is just very mild but firm, and refuses to be stereotyped as an emotional crusader, and just says, well, you know, these are the facts, and here they are.
I see in your column that you quote Robert White Stevens, who was a former biochemist and spokesman for the chemical industry during the 1960s. He called her, quote, a fanatic defender of the cult of the balance of nature. He warned the public that if man were to follow the teachings of Miss Carson, we would return to the Dark Ages, and the insects and diseases and vermin would once again inherit the earth. Ironic, because if we keep ignoring climate change, as many who say, we're going to be going back to the Dark Ages.
Well, but I think that this is one of the skillful ways that people who don't take environmental concerns seriously or are much more concerned about their own short-term profit or whatever their motivations are, but it's to present environmental concerns as superficial and as anti-progress. You know, that this is retrogressive and that we need to be moving forward. And, you know, if you're going to make an omelet, you got to crack a few eggs and, you know, this is all, you know, this is all worth it. And it's a way that apparently has been very successful in trying to negate these, negate the concerns that you and I and so many others of us are trying to look at. So, I mean, ultimately, as you say, we're all in this together. You know, we are all going to sink or swim on this planet. And so it is frustrating and just sort of shocking at how divided people were in Rachel Carson's time, but continue to be in 2012.
And Professor Unger, do you see students, especially female students, in growing numbers interested in going into environmental studies? I hope so.
I see it with men and women. I wouldn't say it's particularly heavy to women. What I like about it is that these are, are really thoughtful students who are interested in and are proficient in the hard sciences. You know, they are good scientific, you know, thinkers and so forth. They have the evidence behind them, and they're really interested in applying that in ways that are going to, you know, promote environmental awareness and make people's lives better on a day-to-day basis. It's not just like, oh no, people have to suffer so that non-human nature can thrive. I think one of my pet peeves, people talk about, you know, people and the nature. Well, people are part of nature. You know, we're all part of this.
That's a communist thing to say. That's what I was told when I mentioned that on Hannity.
That got
the most hate mail of anything I've ever said, and I was on a half dozen times, to suggest that men and women are part of nature. You wouldn't believe what that set off.
Well, and to me, I mean, I'm with Rachel Carson. We're all part of this web of life. It's all interconnected. I don't see people as intruders on nature. I mean, I think that we have the same rights as animals and other things, you know, to be here, that we're all part of nature. My particular pet peeve is this notion, and I know it's very well intended, but people as the stewards of nature, which I know I have this argument with many people who really support that notion. But to me, that indicates that people have a certain sort of superiority, that we're really in charge. And I think that creates a sort of arrogance that I find dangerous. I think if we talk about the historian Carolyn Merchant, talks a lot about the web of life, and I really like that. You know, if you disrupt one strand, it damages the whole web. So I believe that that people are not, I believe that they have a right to use resources, to consume, you know, to do things and so forth, as long as they understand that this, everything that we do affects everything else, and it's all part of this larger continuum.
Even the phrase conquer nature, man, the concept of man conquering nature, that seems so absurd.
Well, it does, and yet, honestly, looking back, reading some of the philosophers at the turn of the last century, and they're saying, you know, we are in this wonderful battle against nature, and that this is our duty and our responsibility is to conquer nature. That and these ideas that nature either needs to be conquered or that it's somehow incomplete, and that it's up to people to make it better. You know, if we have a desert, we can make that desert bloom. You know, we can divert rivers and bring that into this and make the desert bloom. And therefore, that is our duty and our responsibility to mold nature and to make it do for us what we want it to do for the betterment of humanity. And that idea, has brought us all kinds of massive river projects and so forth. And not every single one of those. I'm not trying to say every single one of them is bad. But there was this real imperative that if you can do it, you should. It was a waste for a river to, you know, reach its natural end and empty into an ocean. That was just a misdirection. God made a mistake in religious terms, and that this water needed to be used, otherwise it was just wasteful and wrong.
Well, speaking of that, since you are local here in the San Francisco Bay Area, you're probably aware that it was three women who saved the bay, actually,
yes,
when they wanted to fill it all in with land.
Yes, I have a little section on them in my book, and they're so frustrated because they, you know, they're well-placed women. Their husbands are big at UC Berkeley, and so they get all of these people who they think are going to be, you know, on board with them and so forth, and they present their idea, and they, all the men just kind of quietly file out. And but as you know, they don't take no for an answer, and they use the various strings that they have available to them through their marriages to you know, bring in different legislators, and they do ultimately they are ultimately able to save a tremendous amount of the bay. I mean, some of the bay had already been filled in by that time, but they managed to save a lot of it. Yeah.
And as someone who grew up in the South Bay and now lives in the North Bay, it's hard to imagine life without that beautiful body of water.
Well, it is, and it's also, I mean, I was teaching at San Francisco State University when we had the big Loma Prieta quake, and a very, very tall dormitory on campus, because it was built on landfill, was so badly damaged that students were never allowed to go back into that building, because into that structure. And, you know, I think that in an earthquake, you know, susceptible area, you know, where we're prone to earthquakes here, landfill it's got a lot of problems. One of them is that it liquefies during an earthquake, and it's very, very dangerous.
Well, I was living in the Marina District, which is on landfill, during the quakes leading up to the Loma Prieta. It was right before I moved to New York, so I was working for CBS Network at the time of the quake and covered it all night long, talking about why certain areas were getting hit harder, like the fire in the Marina, and that experience of being inside a very small room, one of those rooms that's really a large closet where only my bed could fit. I described it as feeling like you're in a bowl of Jell-O surrounded by cardboard, and that's all. It was scary, and that was before
yeah,
the big one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that, and as we know, as we say around here, that really wasn't the big one. That was the pretty big one. You know,
exactly.
The big one is still coming. And,
well,
and you know, if all scientific, you know, evidence is correct, that that it's on its way and it's going to be, you know, bigger and harder. So so again, I don't think that everything should be left untouched, but I do think we need to think long and hard before we start manipulating nature and really thinking about all the different aspects that come along with that. And I do think that while there is this debate now about what's right and what's wrong about that, one of the things that I do take heart in is at least there's a debate. I mean, prior to, you know, really in through the, I would say until the progressive era at the turn of the last century, it was pretty much just everybody was on board. Nature was to be conquered, and that was all that there was to it. And we don't really see, you know, until we see probably the best known, as you know, is John Muir really trying to save Hetch Hetchy Valley. And for my purposes, I find this fascinating because he gets a lot of support from women's groups. And women's groups say, yes, we should preserve this beautiful valley. And so many on the other side are saying, what are you talking? You see, women, they're just sentimental. They're foolish. You know, they're standing in the way of progress. And the way that John Muir is ridiculed, I have a cartoon of him. They dress him up in this cartoon wearing a dress and a bonnet, and he's trying to sweep back the progress that is the water flooding Hetch Hetchy Valley. So, you know, we've had a few little examples of people, you know, beginning to question exploitation of the environment. But to me, on the one hand, in 2012, it's more dangerous than it's ever been, but I also think that there's more environmental awareness and concern and talk than I've ever seen in this country. And looking back on its history, I really think that that's remarkable. The idea that whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, you have to talk about the environment, I think is really an important step.
Well, let's hope the conversation gets around to the environment for tonight's debate and the debates to follow and in the conversation leading up to the election and then, of course, beyond. Nancy Unger, thank you so much for your book, Beyond Nature's Housekeepers, American Women in Environmental History. We'll be back right after these messages to talk about the climate silence and the debates and more with Desi Doyen and also Daniel Kessler at 350.org. Stay with us.
wouldn't really.